This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
Okay, and I apologize. I looked over the handout, and as I said, I actually defended my dissertation on Thursday, so it's been a little bit crazy. So in the list for works cited, I have not included two works that I will be citing. So there should be Peter Smith's 1981 work, The Nursling of Mortality, a study of the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite, as well as Monica Serino, 1995 book, In Pandora's Jar, Love Sickness in Early Greek Poetry. Thank you. Okay. From one mythical vantage point, a vantage point embraced by the Romans, and henceforth by subsequent overviews of Greek myth, Eros appears well integrated within the Olympian community. He is the son of Aphrodite and Ares, two of Zeus's Olympian children. In the third book of Apollonius' Argonautica, we see him as a charming scamp playing in his grandfather's Olympian orchard. He is even promised Zeus's childhood toy when Aphrodite interrupts his game with Ganymede to secure his assistance in Jason's quest for the Golden Fleece. The god's appearance as a little boy, along with his genealogical position as an offspring of Zeus's children, facilitates his characterization as one of the youngest of the gods, voiced, for instance, by Plato's Agathon and by Pausanias, who frames it as the belief held by most people. And this is number one in the handout. In short, as he is commonly known, the god of love appears as one of the beautiful, shiny new deities who, along with the ascendancy of Zeus, set the Olympian era apart from the chaotic, brutish, primordial murkiness of what came before. This Olympian coloring can be traced all the way back to Hesiod's Theogony, where Eros is characterized as the most beautiful of the immortals and appears as a companion of the lovely Aphrodite on her way to join the divine community after her birth from the sea's waters. But, as we well know, Hesiod did not envision Eros as the youngest of the gods. From the mythological vantage point of the Theogony, Eros is actually a parentless, primordial force that emerges along with Gaia and Tartarus at the very beginning of the formation of the cosmos. And this is handout 2A. In truth, first of all chasm came to be, and then broad-breasted earth, the ever-immovable seat of all the immortals who possess snowy Olympus's peak, and murky Tartarus in the depths of the broad-pathed earth, and Eros, who is the most beautiful among the immortal gods, the limb melter. He overpowers the mind and thoughtful counsel of all the gods and of all human beings in their breast. This primeval aspect, in turn, aligns with depictions of Eros's elemental origin in other authors. For instance, Sappho seems to have made him a Titan, a child of Gaia and Uranus, while for the logographer Acusilaus, he was born from Nyx and fathered either by Erebos or Aether. Eros is also identified with the winged Phanis, also termed the Protogonos of Orphic cosmology, who emerges out of a cosmic egg at an early stage of the universe. Possibly influenced by Orphic ideas, the Pterugus, one of the technopygnia of the Alexandrian Simmias, presents Eros as the son of chaos and a sceptered participant in the succession of primeval cosmic rulers. This is a primal, non-Olympian Eros, who not only antecedes the establishment of the Olympian order on a genealogical level, but in some accounts represents a rival configuration to that order, an order defined by the hegemony of Zeus. In essence, what we find here is another god. Although Hesiod is our first source for this cosmic and elemental dimension of Eros, as we have already noted, His theogony also conveys the god's more familiar role as the complement of Aphrodite. Handout 2A. Whose divine province, Hertime, among gods and men, encompasses maidenly whispers and smiles and deceits and sweet delight and fondness and gentleness. This dichotomy of Hesiod's Eros, who on the one hand resembles the Olympian personification of desire that we find in later poets, and on the other is introduced as a primordial elemental force that fits our definition of another god, has prompted scholars, including Macer, Fastje, and Rudhart, to postulate that Hesiod channeled and combined two distinct traditions. In turn, Claude Calame has rejected this hypothesis on the grounds of the conceptual compatibility of Eros's cosmic role as a demiurge with his identity as the god of desire and a forger of social relations. I agree with Calame that there is no need to hypothesize the existence of two different deities to account for the primordial and elemental, the nether god dimension of Eros in Hesiod's theogony, or in other analogous accounts of the god. But I also think that we can go beyond a conceptual justification. For if we take a closer look at the poetic treatment of Eros in his role as a personification of desire, as a divine complement of Aphrodite, the apparent incompatibility of this aspect of the god with his identity as an elemental force rooted in a primordial universe is exposed as a result of limited understanding. In fact, the non-cosmogonic Eros that we find across the different genres and periods of Greek poetry is in many ways likewise a primal force operating beyond and at times at odds with the Olympian order under Zeus's patronage. Let's first take a closer look at Eros's Olympian parentage. Simonides is our first source for Ares as his father, while Sappho seems to be the first to make him the child of Aphrodite, though, as we have noted, she also attributes this role to Gaia. Eros is thus aligned with the two gods whose position within the Olympian order, within the Olympian community, is particularly precarious, both because of their friction with Zeus, the head and emblem of this community, and because of what Ares and Aphrodite represent, namely volatile forces that threaten Zeus's rule in as much as it is a rule that is profoundly aligned with the structures of civilized existence. As the personification of raw violence, which is unmediated by reason, in contrast to Athena's patronage of the craft and strategy of warfare, for instance, Eros represents the kind of destructive energy that continually tests the restraints mitigating brutality in ordered communities. This conceptual tension underpins the dramatic depiction of the Olympian king's abhorrence of his son that we find in the Iliad. At the conclusion of the fifth book, Ares, who is suffering from an injury at the hands of Diomedes, sits beside Zeus, shows him his bleeding wound, and plaintively remonstrates with him for allowing Athena to facilitate a mortal's attack against the gods. If we remember, Diomedes was also able to wound Aphrodite during his Aristeia. The response Ares receives from his father is striking for its unabashed hostility, and this is handout 3A. Zeus tells him, "To me you are most hateful of all the gods who hate Olympus. Forever quarreling is dear to your heart, wars and battles." He deigns to have Ares healed only because he is, after all, his child. But he does not forbear to inform him that if it were not for this fact, Ares would have been thrown out of Olympus, and so effectively out of the Olympian community. Handout 3b. "But were you born of some other god and proved so ruinous, long since you would have been dropped beneath the gods of the bright sky." Zeus's hostility towards Ares is paralleled by his antagonism towards Aphrodite in a poem that is essentially a story of the punishment inflicted on her by her father. I speak of the longer Homeric hymn to Aphrodite. Its narratio relates the instance when Zeus turned the tables on the goddess of love and used her divining power against her, so that by bedding a mortal man, she suffers a perpetual onedos, a shaming reproach among her fellow Olympians. Her conflict with Zeus, in turn, aligns with the dichotomy whereby Aphrodite is presented as a natural elemental force that threatens an ordered universe and the structures of civilized life. The hymn opens with an overview of Aphrodite's sweeping influence, handout number 4. We are told that she overwhelmed the tribes of mortal men and the birds of the air and all the beasts, and as many as the land nourishes and the sea. Correspondingly, a fragment of Sophocles proclaims the presence of Aphrodite within the creatures of sea, land, and air. I'm just going to read the fragment. She enters into the swimming race of fishes. She is within the four-legged brood upon dry land, and her wing ranges among the birds. So returning to the hymn. Remarkably, the hymnist then devotes a significant part of his work to the goddesses who have successfully resisted Aphrodite's attacks. We are told that in vain she attempted to penetrate their hearts, their phrenas. Athena did not find her works pleasing, Artemis resisted her effort to subdue her, and Hestia vehemently rejected her. As A.S. Brown puts it, these three, and I quote, are behind the divining institutions and primary benefits of human society. Furthermore, it follows that if the goddesses are opposed to Aphrodite, then on the human plane, she must be an impediment to the worthy carrying out of the important activities they patronize, end of quote. In other words, all that the hymn has the goddesses represent, which includes military and hunting technology, weaving, music, ritual dance, cities of law-abiding men, the hearth, and the temples of the gods, all this is threatened by the aggressive Aphrodite. Sappho actually offers a neat illustration of Aphrodite's interference with one of Athena's prerogatives. In fragment 102, a girl tells her mother, "Truly, sweet mother, I cannot weave my web, for I am overcome with desire for a boy because of slender Aphrodite." Now, the Homeric hymn suggests that it is the domain of Hestia that is particularly under threat from Aphrodite. The poet allocates the greatest number of verses to this goddess, elevates her position with a list of honors, and presents her rejection of Aphrodite as the most vehement, relating that she even took a vow to safeguard her virginity. Significantly, Hestia is not only closely associated with the oikos, but also with her brother Zeus. Her ability to remain an eternal virgin is an expression of his will. It happens boule dios. Zeus gives Hestia her position in the center of the oikos and all of her honors. Moreover, she has vividly subordinated herself to him. Andrew Faulkner points out that, I quote, "the language with which Hestia is said to swear an oath by touching or grasping Zeus's head has similarities with that of supplication," end of quote. Thus, the poet elicits an image of the goddess with her knees bent, reaching up to the powerful patriarch's head in acknowledgement of his power over her and her dependence upon him. Peter Smith observes that when the poet highlights Zeus's role in authorizing Hestia's perpetual virginity, he is, in effect, stressing, I quote, his ruling position as head of the world's government, the maintainer of order, the giver and protector of rights and honors. End of quote. Therefore, what Aphrodite appears to threaten most in her hymn is not only the oikos, of which Hestia is the fixed center, but also male ascendancy, which on the small scale sustains the oikos, on the large scale directs the state and maintains order at all levels of society. Her Homeric hymn also positions Aphrodite's activity as a threat to the stability of a universal order, in as much as this is connected with the cosmic rule of Zeus over a hierarchical system characterized by differential relations. Aphrodite compels gods and men to blur the boundaries of the hierarchical division between human and divine. Anne Berggren points out that these works of the goddess result in an illicit mixture of categories, recalling the fact that sexual intercourse is denoted in Greek by the verb megnemi, to mix. The erga aphroditas produce a cosmos of mixture that challenges the distinctions that make for cosmic meaning. Berggren further observes that in the cosmos of Aphrodite, the hierarchical order dependent upon the preeminence of Zeus collapses as he joins the other gods, men, and animals whom the goddess can interbreed. In addition to endangering the cosmic order through her illicit mixtures, the goddess constitutes a grave threat to the integrity of civilized life through her influence on its foundational core, the mind and its constructs and projections. For Greek texts show that when sexual passion, regarded as a primal and often violent impulse, comes in contact with what can be roughly designated as rational or culturally conditioned thought processes, it can overwhelm them utterly. In the Dios Apate episode, Homer tells us that Aphrodite's kestos robs of their minds even those who think prudently or intelligently. And this is handout 5a. Eclipse noon, pika per phroneonton. This gnomic statement is soon particularized as we witness what happens to Zeus when he falls under the kestos's power. And this is handout 5b. Eros muffles even the pycnias phrenos. Eros muffles even his pycnias phrenos. Richard Janko notes that the expansion of the phrenos with the epithet pycnias, quote, aptly stresses the intelligent that is overcome, end of quote. Correspondingly, her Homeric hymn proclaims that Aphrodite has repeatedly led astray the mind of Zeus, tricking his pycnias phrenos. Handout number 6. Thus, in opposition to Zeus's cosmos, Aphrodite appears to marshal a rival regime, which not only collapses hierarchical differentiation, but by undermining the rational mind, imperils the integrity of civilized life and its regulatory structures. As the embodiment of desire, a passion that falls within the divine province of Aphrodite, Eros, not surprisingly, partakes in these unsettling aspects of the goddess. Like her, he is also depicted as an elemental natural force, both in his clearly anthropomorphic aspect and when the distinction between the feeling and the god is left uncertain. He is often absorbed into weather phenomena. For instance, Sappho assimilates his onslaught to the force of wind upon a tree. Correspondingly, Apollonius characterizes the dialogue of the clandestine rendezvous between Medea and Jason as occurring under the blowing of Eros, hupno pnoeisin erotos. The meteorological conceit becomes linked with mythical genealogy when Alcaeus declares that Eros is the product of the mixing of the west wind and the rainbow. Meleager suggests love is like a sea storm, wherein Eros's waves are blown by sleepless jealousies. Cercidas envisions Eros as capable of rousing hurricanes or whirlwinds of desire and causing an unceasingly stormy passage over the sea. As Monica Serrano observes, Anacreon enriches his comparison of Eros to a blacksmith, with a quote, a distinct notion of love's elemental surge of power, end of quote, by having the love god douse his speaker in a wintry torrent. Ibycus emphasizes the fearsome quality of Eros, likened to a wind rushing from the side of Aphrodite, by figuratively endowing him with the burning power of lightning. The element of fire and its effects dominate the figurative language of amatory poetry in Hellenistic texts. Thus, we have the celebrated simile of Apollonius that likens the onset of Medea's passion for Jason, which had been instigated by the arrows of Eros, to the increasingly consuming power of a flame kindled by a working woman. Theocritus connects Eros with fire in a number of his extant idylls, most prominently in his second, in which, for instance, a character declares that Eros kindles a fire more blazing than that of Hephaestus on Lipari. Moschus has Aphrodite proclaim that of all of Eros's savage weapons, his torch is the worst and can set the sun itself ablaze. Correspondingly, Meleager refers to the god as an agrios daimon who throws torches into a lover's breast. As with Aphrodite, Greek texts stress Eros's presence in the natural world. The chorus of the Hippolytus delineates his primal quality. Handout number 7. Over the earth he flies, and the loud echoing salt sea. Eros bewitches the race of the mountain-hunting lions and beasts of the sea, and all the creatures that earth feeds, and the blazing sun sees, and man too. The chorus of Sophocles' Antigone voices a similar sentiment as it sings to Eros of his roamings over the sea and among the homes of those who dwell in the wild. Not only is Eros positioned within the wilderness, he is frequently characterized as wild himself. In addition to direct qualifications such as agrios, we can find more dramatic characterizations, such as that in Theocritus' third idyll, where the suffering lover asserts that cruel Eros was born in the wild and suckled by a lioness. And it is the savage aspect of Eros that subtly destabilizes the Olympian vision of the god in the Argonautica that featured in my introduction. Apollonius depicts him as an unruly child who, unrestrained by cultural conventions, disrespects and attacks his mother. Indeed, in one of his epigrams, Meleager explicitly connects Eros's brattiness towards Aphrodite with his wildness. Moreover, although Apollonius makes Eros participate in scenes peopled with Ganymede, Aphrodite, and a number of mortal characters, the divine rascal does not himself utter a single word. The only sound we ever hear from him is a malicious cackle, both when he unethically crushes Ganymede in their game of knucklebones and as he darts up after striking Medea with his flame-like arrow. Underscoring this rather feral characterization, Apollonius likens Eros's arrival at the house of Aetes to the attack of a gadfly, availing himself of the conceit of the erotic gadfly found as early as a fragment of Simonides. In Theocritus, we find the identification of Eros with another blood-sucking parasite. The lovesick Simaitha compares him to a leech, handout number 8. In an apostrophe to the god, she asks, "O cruel Eros, why, like a leech from the marsh, have you fastened on me and drunk all the black blood from my body?" In turn, the god's snake-like nature is intimated by Sappho and Archilochus and echoed by Apollonius. They speak of Eros as something that creeps or coils under the heart. In one of Meleager's epigrams, the narrator finds Eros in a phaleos, a word for the den of animals. Nicander uses it for the lair of snakes. Meleager also terms Eros a complete pteros, a designation which we also find applied to a serpent, the snaky Gorgon's head and the serpent-bearing Cerberus. Bion identifies the god with a dangerous bird, an evil beast, a kakon therion that everyone should flee. In the Greek imagination, the power of Eros is not only intimately implicated in the natural world, it is also marked by a sense of an aggressive menace that puts it at odds with the integrity of ordered existence. Moreover, the very extent of Eros's power, the universal sway with which he, along with Aphrodite, is credited, poses an implicit challenge to the preeminence of Zeus. Indeed, the notion that Eros can overcome even the ruler of the universe develops into a cliché. In Theocritus 30, Eros is described as a god who trips up even the great mind of Zeus. Sophocles exposes the paradox. The all-powerful Zeus does not actually have the strength to drive away Eros. Handout number 9. By the Hellenistic period, the lover in an epigram by Asclepiades, handout number 10, without the need for further identification, can simply speak to Zeus of being compelled by the same god who rules him as well. So line 5. Ho kraton kai sou theos. In fact, the lover's taunting of Zeus echoes Prometheus's defiance in the Prometheus Bound, as noted by Gowan Page. In one of the Greek anthologies, an anonymous Hellenistic epigrams, the speaker, described as drunk with madness and armed with thoughtlessness, goes so far as to proclaim himself invulnerable to Zeus's missiles because he carries the invincible shield of Eros. In fact, if we return to our scene in the Argonautica, we can see that Apollonius likewise conveys the challenge to Zeus's control of the world posed by Eros. He suggested this through the toy that belongs to Zeus, but is now promised to the divine scamp by his mother. The toy is a marvelous golden ball that in a number of ways suggests a correspondence with the cosmos itself. Like Aphrodite, Eros also proves detrimental to the integrity of the mind. An epigram from the Greek anthology presents the mind of the speaker who is caught by Eros as cast into fire, while Apollonius speaks of the torpor of Medea's mind at the moment she is struck with Eros's arrow. And this destructive influence on the mind translates to more tangible, more widespread destruction. In the Antigone, the chorus blames Eros for stirring up the quarrel between blood kin, Creon and his son, which ultimately leads to the death of both Haemon and his mother. This is handout number 11. In the Trachiniae, we are told that Eros alone caused Heracles to attack and ultimately destroy the city of the Nubae Paeole. Quite striking is the indictment which opens book 2 of the Theognidea. So this is handout 12. "Cruel Eros, the spirits of madness took you up and nursed you. Because of you, Troy's Acropolis was destroyed, and great Theseus, Aegeus' son, and noble Ajax, Oileus' son, through your acts of recklessness. The destruction of Theseus by Eros probably refers to the hero's trip to and consequent imprisonment in Hades as companion to Pirithous, who was inflamed with the desire for an impious union with Persephone. Indeed, the ruinous, destructive quality of Eros is generally acknowledged by Greek poets. In the Hippolytus, the chorus speaks of Eros as a tyrant of men, destroying them and casting them into every misfortune when he comes. Both Apollonius and Moschus qualify Eros as oulos, and the former goes on to address him as a great calamity for men. Handout number 13. Mega pema anthropoisin. Adding, from you come deadly quarrels and groans and laments and countless other pains besides these are stirred up. In both Meleager and Dioscorides, the god is termed brotoloigos, a plague for men. In a fragment of the comic poet Aristophon, he causes such troubles for the Olympians that they actually throw him out of Olympus. And if that's not enough, they cut off his wings so that he cannot return. They give them to Nike. So it's at least recycling. Meleager also declares that Eros is abhorred everywhere and by everyone. And this is handout 14. Given all this, it is little wonder that Alcaeus labels Eros deinotatos theon. In the words of Bruce Thornton, I quote, like fire and storm, disease and death, the Greeks' Eros is a force of nature, indiscriminate, chaotic, relentlessly attacking civilization and its orders, the mind and its projections onto the world, the political and social structures that clear the space for human identity, end of quote. Even in his non-cosmic identity, Eros is very much like Hesiod's primordial god, and going back to handout 2A. He is very much like Hesiod's primordial god, the melter of limbs, a qualification with strong affiliations with the destructive workings of death, and actually of sleep as well. There seems to be this matrix of sleep, death, and Eros, who overpowers the mind and the thoughtful counsel of all the gods and of all human beings in their breast. The Olympian veneer of the god, who embodies sweet desire, the divine complement of Aphrodite, cracks under close scrutiny and reveals the dark essence of another god. Dr. Strauss Clay has observed that Hesiod's primordial Eros joins the entourage of Aphrodite, I quote, who does not belong to the first principles, but is fully personified to become her subordinate. This subordination to Aphrodite, which is, I quote, necessary for the establishment of a stable cosmos, is the first step in the taming of the generative principle, end of quote. The explicit positioning of Eros within the Olympian fold that we find in later poets continues this process of taming. Nevertheless, the dark, the unolympian, the nether god dimension of the god continues to assert itself and destabilize his integration into a supernatural group aligned with the benefits and regulatory structures of civilized life and defined by the supremacy of Zeus, the guarantor of cosmic order. The effort to tame, to regulate, and moderate the wild energy of Eros on the one hand, and the god's resistance to these modes of control on the other, reflect the tension between the primal sexual drive that connects us with the animal world and the cultural mechanisms that separate us from this world. It reflects the struggle that permeates the societal and personal negotiations of the ancient world and of our own time, the ever-present and dynamic feature of the human condition, the struggle for control between rationality and visceral impulse, between the mind and the heart. Thank you.